This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Gaze podcast. You can hear us live on Joy 94.9 Saturday afternoon via the live stream at joy.org.au/listen live. Or tune your wireless in Melbourne to 94.9 FM.
1, 2, 3, 4. Use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, nail it, grade it, change the point it, tune it, press it, snap it, work it, click it, erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, click.
Good evening, good evening, good evening, good evening, good evening. This is Techno Gaze here on Joy 94.9, the show where we gaze into the world of consumer electronics, gadgets and technology. Michael, you're about to say something, Anne.
I don't know whether 5 o'clock is really evening. I know it's getting darkish, but you know, it's not evening. What time zone are you in, Mark?
I'm pretty sure I'm in Australian Eastern Time Zone. Is that what it's called?
No, we're not in Australia.
What?
Wrong place. Go back.
Gosh. No, the reference is, of course, Stephen Fry. I've always wanted to say that. And at least it's more appropriate to go with good evening now than what it is previously when we were on at midday.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Now, Technogaze. We talk about tech. We consume electronics, gadgets, that sort of thing.
And anything that plugs into power.
That voice is Michael. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Mark. Hello, stranger.
And it's good to be back. And we've also got in the studio with us Craig.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. What?
What time zone are you in?
Well, I always say good morning because I never can be bothered trying to work it out. And, you know, my response is always, it's morning somewhere in the world. So
yeah.
Yes, it was morning. Well, yeah, it is morning now in, I guess, the UK, which I was in just recently, just dropping it in there.
Apart from other places around the world, we all know about your Hungarian sausage.
What Hungarian sausage? I did post on Facebook.
Exactly.
Indeed. Now, on today's show...
Oh, there's a show, is there?
Yeah, we've got a whole bunch of things going on. What are we talking about? We've got Raspberry Pis. There's some interesting developments there. Some products being made available to make very cheap desktop or thin clients through Raspberry Pis. Elon Musk of Tesla fame has introduced his version of a battery, a wall-mounted battery, which hopefully will start to solve the problem of renewable energy and baseload power.
And I think it shows what a good sell job he does.
A what job?
A sell job.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, we've got a few other little battery sort of items to talk through as well, because there's some very interesting new developments in the battery world. There's some concern in privacy over the other side of the ditch. The Kiwis have not been able to opt out of their phone data being used in information being collected. So
it's amazing, actually, this story, that the sheer audacity of it, really.
Mm, well, yeah, it's kind of, yeah, sound the alarms, people. And of course, over this side of the ditch, Telstra must now hand over some personal information for the journalist Ben Grubb of the Fairfax stable. He has been he's taken Telstra to court for quite some time and trying to get his access to his own personal data, and has finally won that, although apparently Telstra will
appeal
because they're a big corporation and that's what they do. What else we got? I don't know. I shouldn't give the game away too early, should I?
No, you should not.
Now that I'm back, you have neglected Apple, haven't you?
We have had no stories about Apple in the last 4 weeks. Not.
Gasp.
No, that has not been the case. We just haven't been necessarily as biased towards Apple as...
Oh, I'm not biased. I appreciate good quality. Anyway, I did manage to get get a watch on my wrist while overseas. Not that you can't do that here as well. You can always book an appointment, and I have a bit of a thing to say about that. We've also got a few news items to talk about. Hopefully we get time. That is a drumbeat that has just finished, actually. So let's, shall we get on to the
Raspberry pies?
Yeah.
With cream, I think, is nice because some people like with ice cream, but cream goes. Oh, wrong show. What is the Raspberry Pi?
Raspberry Pi. It's a tiny little device. It's actually like a circuit board, which is a computer in itself. There's nothing much to it. You can insert an SD card into it, and that's your storage. So you might choose to get a 32 gig SD card and just put it in there. Very low power usage as well. So it's actually powered through like a USB port. And it's very bare bones. So.
And it's cheap. I think they sell, what, $50 Australian?
Yeah, $50. Or just under 50? It varies. Yeah, about $50 is how much you'd buy one for. But that's just for the actual circuit board.
Yep.
All the extra bits you then need to buy. So it's a great way to, you know, if you want to configure it to your own specs, you can do that. And the other thing about it is, like, actually one of the pitfalls as well is the cases. So you actually need to buy your own case for it to be enclosed in something. Otherwise, it's just sitting on your desk
as a
circuit board with pretty lights on it. Anyway, so this is it's been around for quite some time. There's been multiple iterations of it. But just recently, the company Parallels, which you may be familiar with because they do virtualization software for Macs. They have done for quite some time now. In fact, they were big before even VMware got into the game with VMware
on the Mac side. Yeah.
In fact, they were the go-to virtualization software package for Mac long ago. Anyway, they've made a new product available which can be installed on a Raspberry Pi, and it enables Windows connectivity. So what this will do for the very small price of, what, 15 user license, $1,400, it'll give you it'll allow you to use that Raspberry Pi to connect to your Windows servers.
Yeah, so it's essentially a remote, it runs the RDP remote desktop protocol.
Mm.
So it's a client that acts as a thin client to allow you to connect to a remote computer.
And often the case is like IT shops around the place will have these Windows services available, but they're not widely used because the actual cost of getting devices out in to run these things like the Raspberry Pi might be used for, to actually for people to be sitting in
the hardware device, the keyboard, the screen. Yep.
That cost is still quite high compared to just having a very cheap desktop machine,
especially when the cost of PCs these days, desktops, is really low.
Yeah, like what, $300-$200
yeah.
these days. So, you know, $50 for one of those is actually quite a reasonable price. And if you could build it into the desk, for example, suddenly you've got a very nifty solution to your enterprise needs.
Hmm.
So that's high. Yes, that's a high. Also on the sort of the enterprise front, Microsoft have been doing they've got their Build conference, which is a big conference. It's actually a showcase for Microsoft to...
That's their annual developer conference, is it?
Yeah, it enables them to show off what all the new wares that they've got, anything that's coming up in the future that developers in particular should be aware about. And one of the new developments is a thing called Nano Server. And along the same lines, it's like the bare bones stuff. So where the Raspberry Pi is like a circuit board, the Nano Server in the Microsoft world is actually just a bare bones operating system. So it's been touted as the future of Windows Server, and basically it's a way for for us to install these very low level Windows servers for the cloud.
And one of the issues with Windows Server is that when you install it, the footprint, certainly in terms of disk space, is something like over 6 gig because everything gets copied down when you install it, even the stuff that you don't need.
Yep.
And when you do go to the cloud and you want to replicate farms of servers, so you have literally hundreds and thousands of them, that you've got all of this additional extra requirement that you don't need. And I dare say there's a fair amount of memory bloat as well with it loading lots of stuff that isn't being used.
Yeah.
And I think this is a design change or a design philosophy change with the whole Windows Server line, because Nano Server is not a separate product. It is going to be part of a future Windows Server.
Yep.
And I think it's going to be one of the tiers that the other versions of Windows Server, the normal versions, with the will build upon, and this is just one tier.
Yeah, so it's like the base level is Nano.
Yep.
And then you say, oh, I want a GUI on top of it, or I want a web server on top of it, or whatever. And so it's like the starting point. And this, to be fair, I mean, this has kind of existed for quite some time in the Microsoft world with their Server Core
product. Yeah.
Which, I mean, back in Server 2008, they had that sort of capability. But I think they've actually gone to the next level, and particularly from a cloud services point of view, where you talk about, you know, replicating the same things, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of times in some cases, that can create, like, that 6 gig of memory required or hard disk required to just keep those superfluous things. There, you know, that does mount up when you times it by how many
thousands, hundreds. Mm. Indeed.
So it's really a way for them to offer their operating system for the cloud, and not surprising considering Microsoft have moved quite heavily into cloud services, what with Azure and
the competition.
Yes, indeed. Now we should come back in a few moments. We have Tesla on the way back from a quick break, so we'll do that in just a few moments.
All day, every day. Joy 94.9. On air and online at joy.org.au.
Indeed, joy.org.au is a great way to listen to us, as I did when I was over in Europe not that long ago.
Oh, were you in Europe? I didn't know that. Craig, did you know he was in Europe?
No, he's never mentioned it.
No, it was a surprise. There was nothing on his Facebook page either. He was so quiet and shy.
Yeah, he was. I mean, I did miss him for a little while. I just thought he'd gone a bit quiet.
Miss who? Actually, if I turn off his mic, he won't be here.
Help, my name is Mark and I'm being abducted.
Go on, Mark.
Now, shall we get back into tech news, as this show often does?
Do it, please.
Yes, all right. Okay, Tesla. Elon Musk. I'd actually like to have his babies. he's a lovely gentleman, very forward-thinking. So the big splash I think it's this week, wasn't it?
It was.
I'm pretty sure. I've been a bit jet lagged, so I might get my timings wrong, but yeah, no. This week, a whole battery system was announced by Elon Musk of Tesla fame. Of course, Tesla is the car company that has produced a completely battery powered car, which is actually a very sporty, quite highly priced car. But comparable in terms of power output and so forth of your combustion engine.
I don't know if it's comparable. I think it's better than.
Better than, well.
Certainly it's got many more torques than your regular cars.
I guess in that, and I was talking to a mutual friend of yours and mine.
Oh, really?
Michael, and the benefit of a battery pack is that you get torque right from the beginning.
You get 100% torque all the way through.
Yes.
And torque, for those that don't know, is pulling power, for want of a better term.
When you put your foot down, how much it might take off, basically.
Yes.
Now, so Tesla have been famous for cars for quite some time, but of course, because they've been developing batteries that they can put into these cars, suddenly there's a new market for them to enter, and that market is batteries.
And that's why they're building the Gigafactory.
Yes. Yes, I've got this Gigafactory.
Well, it's called the Gigafactory. I thought that was its proper name, the Gigafactory.
I think it is, yeah. But it's a factory specifically built to create batteries.
And the output of the Gigafactory, in terms of the number of batteries they're going to make a year, is going to be the same as the current global output of batteries is today. So they're essentially going to be doubling the availability of batteries.
Wow.
Kind of feels like it's kind of dangerous.
What, all these batteries can ever take us?
Well, you know, from like a resource point of view.
Look, I guess on one hand it is, and this is one of the things that I think's not heard enough about, not thought about enough in terms of electric vehicles, is that everyone says, oh, look how efficient it is, this is how much it costs per kilowatt and the equivalent cost. But we need to look at the whole chain from, you know, birth to the cradle type thing, or cradle to death, of what resources do you need to create the batteries?
What rare metals are in particular?
And what happens at the end of the life of the battery? What do you do with it?
Yeah. Does it just get chucked in the ground and ooze out?
That's
God
right.
knows.
But yeah. unlike regular fuel, at least you can make electricity, whether it be from the sun or something else. So it is renewable, which...
Yeah. Well, it could be renewable.
Yeah. Well, it depends how you source it, yes. You burn oil to make power.
Yeah. Well, that's... Yeah. So, in effect, batteries, though, do future-proof us in that regard. So electricity is creatable in by many means, not just fossil fuels. And we'll talk about in just a few moments other battery options that are being developed as well that may solve the precious metal concern. But this, going back to the actual story here, Elon Musk has announced the what's called the Powerwall. And it's geared for home battery systems. So given at a price at around $3,500, which... When you take into account, maybe if you want to get yourself off the grid and you've got solar panels,
yep,
that's roughly the double the price of what you pay for solar panels to do a similar thing, I think. I mean, maybe I've got my math wrong, but the idea is for this power wall to be installed in homes, maybe in your on the outside of your wall or in your garage or something, and you might have solar panels on the roof, and they feed into this battery, and therefore the battery could be used for energy use overnight.
And that's one of the drawbacks of using current renewable energy, like solar or even wind power, is that it's very peaky. So what do you do, you know, 12 o'clock during the day is fine. At night time, what do you do? And that's where the battery comes in as a solution of storing that energy, and you can draw it out.
And I think actually that's one of the problems that I guess all the non-renewable energy people out there sort of point out when it comes to renewable energy, is that it is so sporadic. You're at the whim of the elements when it comes to wind or solar in particular.
Yep.
There's no way of really controlling when that power input is going to come. So the battery solution is actually the missing link there. And if it is consumerized in the way that Elon Musk is suggesting it should be, then, you know, it's suddenly we've got all the issues of redundancy and, you know, gold plating our power delivery systems and so forth suddenly go out the window, because it's actually a solar panel on your roof driving a battery that's in your home. So you're not so reliant on this
outside
huge grid that may or may not work on any given day.
The future of power is that everybody is independent and you really use the main grid as your backup.
Yes.
So if your local supply fails, you get it off the grid.
Yeah. Well, that'd be really interesting to see what's going to happen to all of the electricity companies and how they're going to deal with it.
That's right.
Because all of a sudden they're going to be, you know, because they're profit driven, and then all of a sudden they're going to be faced with this, well, we're not going to make that much profit anymore.
And the hard thing is they have to make huge investments up front, which, you know, may last 10, 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
There's going to come a stage where they say, well, we're not going to do that. And then if they stop investing in their infrastructure and you start to have reliability problems, what happens to those people that aren't independent?
Yeah.
You then have reliability issues when you're getting power off the grid.
Could create a two-tier sort of system or arrangement, I guess, where the people who have money are able to afford the upfront cost of a battery system. I mean, you could think about maybe government getting involved and you know, every new house built gets a new battery installed as well. I mean, and what about maintenance of that battery? And
I also think this would be great if it was coupled with geothermal heating and cooling, which is you can stick essentially a rod that's about a metre or 3 metres down into the ground, and you have free heating and cooling for the whole for the whole year, because essentially you use the earth to regulate the temperature of your house.
Yeah, right.
And even though the offset is actually quite high, it's about $30,000 to get one of these things, but you just have no heating or cooling bills for the rest of the
device. And it suddenly does become a cost-benefit sort of discussion when you really start talking about all these options. Like, the technology is there now. It's actually just working out the price point that actually makes it
worthwhile to do. And, you know, perhaps for existing housing it's going to be difficult to do, but certainly where you are building brand new, developments, why isn't there some sort of infrastructure plan towards that does actually invest the $30,000? And if you do it en masse, it's going to be a lot less for whole neighbourhoods. Yeah. So at the get-go, it's in there. And, you know, even if the government has to pay money and you charge the residents based on some, you know, on a lease basis or something like that to make it more palatable, at least that way, in, you know, it's going to make life a lot better in the long run.
Yeah.
Now, Elon Musk, he's the one who has sort of pushed this battery power wall, so to speak, but there's been some criticism already towards it. Apparently that $3,500 price tag is in fact the wholesale price, not necessarily the retail price.
Yes.
So perhaps we as home consumers will be paying a fair bit more for it. And also the output of these battery devices may not be that quite enough to power an entire home.
Yeah, I've read that the that $3,500 device, which is one of two different batteries, has only got enough energy in terms of output to supply 2,000 watts, which is effectively the same as a hairdryer or microwave.
Mm. I have to say, at this point, I don't think I would mind that. I mean, it would obviously be better if that was developed
higher,
more.
Yeah.
But because at the moment, people who have solar powers can sell the energy to the grid, and then when they need energy, they essentially buy it back. But those prices are not matched.
They're not matched at all, because I think, you know, you sell it for peanuts and then you buy it back for
elephants.
Monkeys.
Yeah.
I'm always a bit cautious about the whole buying it back thing, because energy or electricity in particular is always a real-time thing, right? So when you're selling it, it's part of the grid at that time. It's never, you know, unless power grids suddenly get a whole bunch of storage, you know, batteries themselves, which there is talk about some countries in particular doing that sort of work. I think Germany may even be doing it. We in Australia, perhaps not, because there's not such a... Anyway, let's not get frustrated. But yeah, so it's that whole... You have to be very sort of careful about sort of saying, okay, we sell it back, but actually we're not buying it back from the same energy that we sold. We're actually buying energy that was produced at that time.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I guess so. And the, you know, the one of the issues is with that. I've lost my track of thought. Never mind.
We saw sirens. We saw lights.
We saw flashing lights.
Anyway, shall we move on? Oh, just very briefly, I do want to point out a very funny Twitter feed. Bored Elon Musk. It's a parody Twitter account which illustrates the type of things that perhaps Elon Musk would come up with when he's a bit bored. For example, chewing gum that is designed to disintegrate roughly when the flavor runs out. A digital counter in conference rooms that displays running sum of the time elapsed times the hourly rate of all the people involved.
Oh, I like that.
And my personal favourite is self-driving horses. We all need self-driving horses, right? Anyway.
We do indeed.
You're listening to TechnoGaze. We'll be back with more in a few moments. TechnoGaze here. Mark, Michael, and Craig in the studio.
You forgot who I was, didn't you?
No, I'm getting there. I am a bit tired still.
He just hesitated momentarily because of your immense beauty, which has shocked him.
I'm going to fall off my chair again, Craig.
Careful now. The show might go to pot if that happens. Now, we're talking about batteries because, you know, they're kind of techie, and that's what we do here on TechnoGaze. We talk about tech stuff. And there's a new aluminium battery made available just recently.
Yeah, so there was a university in America who I have...
So they're not aluminium, they're aluminum.
Aluminium, correct.
Yes,
anyway, sorry. They're aluminium and graphite, which is, you know, kind of really, really interesting. So, you know, one of the most widely used batteries that we have at the moment are the lithium batteries, which are in... the iPhones and...
They're everywhere, lithium batteries.
They are everywhere.
Because they've got really good performance characteristics.
They do, except sometimes they explode.
What's wrong with a little fire every now and then?
Isn't this... they're the same batteries that were put into the Dreamliner, the Boeing 787, right? Created certain fires.
What, the ones that heated up?
Mm. Yeah, well, the original or the early lithium batteries would actually just explode in your pocket, phones and in your laptops and things like that.
How comforting.
Yes. Where the new aluminium battery does not.
So why haven't we had aluminium batteries so far?
So the technology with aluminium batteries has been around for quite some time. They've just been very useless.
useless. Right.
Traditionally, these batteries have only had about not even around about 100 recharge cycles, mm-hmm. which is a third of a year if you're talking about an iPhone phone, right? Or something like that.
Or maybe 2 days.
Yeah. Yes. they don't have very high voltage output. They also, if they don't discharge, things go a bit crazy.
Okay.
And they've also had some disintegration of the cathode that they've been using. But this new battery has solved pretty much all of those problems. So the recharge cycle's now 7,500 or above that, where a normal lithium battery is about 1,000.
Oh, okay. That's pretty good then.
Yeah. It can be made so that it's flexible. So for those smartphones that are possibly just going to be screens that can bend and all that stuff,
yeah.
This is going to be fantastic.
Mm, and and this is a reference to a story hopefully we'll cover it later on in the show, but perhaps they'll be able to be embedded in watch wristbands in the future.
Yeah. Mm. And they're also able to be punctured, and it doesn't destroy the battery right away. It also doesn't explode if you puncture it.
Okay, that's really handy.
Yeah, and they're using pretty relatively non-toxic
materials.
Like they've got aluminium, graphite, which, you know, they're in pencils. And they're using just an aluminium salt as the electrolyte.
And there's lots of aluminium around because it's not a precious metal as such. But yeah. I would assume that lithium is reasonably precious.
I think so. It's also... It's hard to get a hold of, I think. Well, more so than aluminium.
So the cost of battery should come down hopefully.
I'm impressed by this number, the 7,500 cycles, charging cycles. Like, you get an iPhone these days and suddenly, you know, maybe 2 years down the track, your battery is kind of gone to shot. It's really, you know, not worth, keeps it charged for maybe 2 hours after that. And you're kind of thinking, well... this is a bit crap. You know, if we get, you know, if we just increase that on its own, suddenly the battery cycle rate, you know, how long a battery lasts in our devices, it goes much higher.
Can I be cynical and say are the manufacturers of such devices going to be really happy about that? Because at the moment it forces you to replace your device. Yeah.
Yes. Well, the other thing is that it recharges insanely quickly. So a smartphone device would charge in about a minute with an aluminium battery.
Okay, I want one.
The downfall at the moment is that the best voltage they've been able to get out of it is about a AAA, AA battery kind of thing.
Right.
So, you know, it's still early days. They accidentally discovered this battery. So they're definitely going to be working on this a lot more and get it up. But it's looking really promising.
That'd be so good to have rapid charging, because the worst thing is you're somewhere... oh, yeah, I've got access to a PowerPoint, plug it in and it starts to trickle in.
Yep. And you're like, but I've got 5 minutes until I need to head out again. Yeah.
Well, the other big thing is really in electric cars, because right now with your electric car, you plug it in and I think the quickest you can charge a battery at 80% is something like 30 or 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. If you can dump a whole lot of power in there really, really quickly, that's going to be really, really good.
I mean, I've seen, like, particularly with the Tesla... trials that they're doing over in the US and the battery companies that set up little stations across, you know, major routes across the US, they actually have systems where you replace the entire battery pack with a pre-charged battery.
Yeah, you pull one out and put another one in. Mm.
To solve that problem of time.
Kind of like a gas bottle exchange system.
Yeah, yeah, it's effectively that. I guess it's, you know, it's about how the current is stored or how the energy is stored in the end. It's not so much about...
whose it is.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I was just thinking about was also there's been a lot of work done using capacitors as storage.
Mm. Yeah.
Because you can store a capacitor with energy and very rapidly transfer it from one device one to another.
Yes.
Do you think that's way of the future, or is it going to be in conjunction with things like aluminium batteries?
I don't think so. I mean, capacitors have been around for a long time. I feel like we possibly would have developed that by now as something useful. Yeah. But, I mean, it could be, especially if you're trying to charge in a minute, then, you know, having a capacitor there that will just give you that charge mostly instantaneously would be a good thing.
Yeah, would be great. So when can I get one of these
aluminium
batteries?
Probably I would easily say within a decade.
You're talking to somebody who has no patience.
That's like, scientists for soon.
Yes,
soon.
Yes, it is.
Soon I got excited. It's like, oh.
Very okay. good. Well, yeah, I do like the battery technology. I think it is kind of the way that our future is headed because, you know, we really have this energy concern that needs to be solved.
Yeah.
Now, shall we move on to some privacy concerns?
And what are the Kiwis doing?
Yeah, well, there's some subscribers over there of a New Zealand telco called Spark. They're going to visit the Hawke's Bay region. I'm not actually sure where Hawke's Bay is in New Zealand. But they'll have their location recorded to help measure real visitor numbers. Now, the telco will tell this market research company which suburb each phone user comes from and where they're headed afterwards as well, which sounds a little bit Big Brotherish, doesn't it?
Yeah, so it's not even just, you know, you have numbers of this many people in a suburb. It's these exact people are in this suburb.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it doesn't talk about, you know, identifying them right down to the person's name, perhaps. But there is at least demographic information that's going to be included in that from the suburbs to make assumptions about the person, perhaps, that is coming in and leaving the area.
I've heard about opting into things, but this is being co-opted because you have no choice, and unless you're aware of the story, you don't know it's even going on.
It's a funny privilege that the telcos have in this world now, where they are essentially the only way that we can get data to us, right? Whether it be through our mobile phones or through fixed line services or so forth. When they start selling themselves out to marketing research companies, and really, is there enough money in that? Like, in comparison to the subscriber fees that they get, how is it that this could be a viable business case? That's what I want to know.
Well, do you know what I think? I think they could offer to give their service away for free on the understanding that your data is going to be used by marketing companies, and they would still be making money.
Ah, yes, the Google approach.
Yes.
Mm. So yeah, a bit scary over that side of the ditch. Speaking of which, I'd just like to say a very quick hello to Jesse, who messaged in just a few moments ago. Hello, Jesse. Yes, he's from London. Actually, good to have Londoners, but New Zealand Londoners.
I thought you were going to say hello to Raina. Hi, Raina.
Oh yes, Raina. Hello, Raina. What? How could we not say hello to Raina?
Well, you said the Dutch.
Indeed. Now, speaking of privacy as well, back on this side of the Tasman, Privacy Commissioner of Australia has ruled that the metadata is personal, and Telstra must now hand over personal data to the journalist Ben Grubb. Now, Ben Grubb is, I guess, he's quite a favourite journalist, tech journalist of ours on TechnoGaze. Works for Fairfax. And last week, I think you guys looked at Telstra allowing customers to gain access to their metadata in the same way that law enforcement agencies too.
Yes, and that was done under the guise of their transparency efforts. And reading this article this week, I feel a little bit hoodwinked that perhaps they were putting a little bit of a spin on something that they were kind of forced to do.
Yeah. So Ben Grubb has actually taken them to court over these personal information. He's arguing that you know, all these government agencies have access to this information, therefore why don't I, and as a person who this information is actually about?
And he did ask Telstra 688 days ago for his metadata on his mobile usage. And it took that long for the Privacy Commission assault, but it took that long in terms of a process for the for him to get access to it, which is crazy because it's his data. Why shouldn't he have access to it?
Yeah, because even, you know, councils, law enforcement agencies, even the RSPCA can get access to this information. Sure, it might not be in exactly the same form as what Ben would be looking for it in. He would be looking for it as his own personal data, regardless of the location or anything like that. So there might be some munging that needs to happen at the telco side to actually get it all to work. But, it is still his information, or it's still my information, the stuff that they store about.
One of the things that Telstra raised in terms of their opposition to this was that if they showed the telephone logs of calls that he received, that those logs would show hidden numbers. So, you know, when you decide to not to broadcast your ID or silent numbers, and that way he'd get access to it. And Ben rightly said that, you know what, I don't want that. Yeah. Filter it out. You obviously know that it's hidden or it's been filtered, then leave it out.
It sounds like a very unintuitive thing for Telstra to say, in fact, because it's almost like they're trying to, you know, provide an argument against providing the data just like with simple response, which could be, hey, just filter it. You know, you must know that that number is private somewhere. So just, you know, just blank it out. Like, what information is actually sent to the RSPCA then? Is that silent number actually sent on?
I think it is. And I don't know under what auspices the RSPCA needs to get this information.
I think it's for animal protection. So,
okay.
You know, there are some legitimate reasons, but then, you know, who might take advantage of those legitimate reasons? Who knows? Anyway, time is getting away from us today, isn't it? So we should probably move on. You're listening to TechnoGaze here on Joy 94.9. We'll be back soon.
TechnoGaze.
TechnoGaze here. Mark, Craig, and Michael in the studio. I thought I'd mix up the order.
Mark, Craig, and chopped liver. Yes.
That's a great welcoming back gift you've given me there.
Although thank this time much. He hesitated on my name, so it's pretty even.
Okay. Chopped liver and chopped liver. And for vegetarians out there, I'm sorry.
Oh, bless. Next up, my favourite part of the show. We're talking about Apple. Apple.
Oh, yes.
Apple Watches. Yes, that company has just released one of the major product releases of the year, one could say, and that is a watch. And we hear a lot of and focus a lot on the negative aspects of Apple Watch, don't we?
Well, don't look at me. It's a human nature thing. When something comes out, and especially Australians, you know, tall poppy syndrome, you say, it's not really as good as they make out, and look at these problems.
Yes. But there is one good news story that came out about the Apple Watch just this week, and that is the story of Molly Watt, who has a genetic disorder that has left her severely deaf and, with the exception of a very small amount of tunnel vision in one eye, is also completely blind. Now, she's actually quite used to using the iPhone. So crossing over to the watch wasn't too difficult when she must have got her order quite early because
with the watch
there's a big backlog of orders. But anyway, she has already obtained a watch, and the watch makes extensive use of the haptic feedback to differentiate between one alert versus another alert. So for example, a phone call might have like taps of a certain frequency and a certain number, whereas a text message might have another sort of set of taps. And that's what the haptic engine is all about. It's this vibrating engine that sits inside. And it's probably, like from what I've felt of it anyway, it's actually more precise in terms of a vibrate than what
you feel on your
phone. You feel from a typical phone. So,
and in fact, Microsoft, Apple have got a term for the haptic feedback on the watch. Don't they call it taptic?
Yes, because it feels like it literally taps. Mm. Yeah,
but it's not a new thing, though, is it? Because you can customize vibratones for your contacts on your iPhone now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
which I use extensively.
Mm. Yeah, actually, I managed to check out the MacBook. The new MacBook, which is the solid state, everything, no fans.
I saw that in the flesh a few weeks ago, and I fell in love with it.
Did you try the
keyboard?
Scratch pad?
Oh, the scratch pad. The pressure sensitive one. No.
So that also has a haptic engine behind it as well, and they've removed the ability for the trackpad to actually move up and down. So if you've got a Mac today, you would probably, you know, if you want to press the touchpad, you can actually press it down and it physically moves as if it's a button.
Yep.
They've removed that ability for the new version, but they've replaced it with your haptic engine. So when you actually press hard enough, it feels like you're still pressing it down. And it literally does because of the way that they've designed the vibrate, the length of it and the sort of just the feel of it. It really does feel like you're pressing down on a button, which is just remarkable in my opinion. But anyway.
Back to Molly.
Molly, yes. So this the discovery that the watch makes extensive use of this haptic feedback means that she's much more capable or much more able to use the functionality, the full functionality of the watch.
And she uses it with maps, and the map actually tells her via the number of taps whether to turn left or right based on whatever destination she's put into her iPhone.
Yeah, and this was a feature that was quite sold quite early on by Apple. So if you had a directions loaded into your watch, you could just, you know, let it go, and you could have your arm sort of swaying by your side, but it would actually just give you a little sort of feedback. So you're not actually sitting there with a phone in your hand, you know, going, is this the right direction? Is that the right direction?
Yep.
It's just literally telling you as you're walking. I'd be curious to see how reliable that is. Like, how good is it at GPS locations, particularly when your phone, which is actually the thing that's driving GPS, is in your pocket, so it may not have
the full... Well, it should be no worse, right?
Well, yeah.
But the problem becomes that if you rely on it because your eyesight isn't there, you can't necessarily tell, you know, is there a road to turn here when it says turn?
Right.
That's the issue. But she does use the watch with her guide dog.
Yes.
So the dog's obviously trained to avoid obstacles and, you know, things like that. But, you know, I read the article and it said that there was 12 taps to turn right and 3 pairs of 2 taps to turn left. And my initial thought was, gee, that's a lot of taps to remember. But then I realized that if you don't have your other senses going and you're used to taps and things like that, you become very naturally skilled at adapting and understanding the output from that.
Also, if you're relying on it, then you will have to differentiate that between all the other taps that mean something else on the phone, like messages and text messages and phone calls and stuff like that. So
yeah, but it's a good use for the watch.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Apple have always traditionally helped out people that have the need for accessible devices. You know, they've just put that little extra effort into their products that perhaps other manufacturers don't. And, you know, this is a sign that's still occurring today, which you know, makes me happy.
I'd have to say it's a functionality I would use.
Yeah, definitely.
It's very handy. So you don't have to, if you know that, you know, the tap means do something, you don't have to look up and actually check some device, you just do it.
It also brings me back to the battery issue, but how long the battery would last when it's guiding you through certain areas. But hey, we won't know until we get our hands on one, perhaps. Yeah.
And then put an aluminium battery in the strap.
In the strap. And there is a possibility, now that you mention that, there was news this week of there perhaps being a hidden port.
Not perhaps. There is a hidden port.
There is a hidden port, I should say. This is actually hidden in the battery. In the strap connector. So when you take the band off an Apple Watch, which is a thing that you can do quite readily, like it's a very easy thing to do, there's actually a 6-pin port that's underneath a sort of a shutter, which is sort of closed, but it's you can open it with a little tool. There's no tool that's provided in the packaging today to allow you to open it, but there is talk that certain third party manufacturers might be given the ability to interface with this port. And one of the uses for this port is to be able to charge. So potentially, with the combination of our earlier story of an aluminium battery that is actually flexible. Combined with a nicely designed watch wristband that has this little port made enabled. Suddenly,
and this port charges the watch more quickly than the induction, doesn't it?
Yes, because that's the other thing. There's a bit of criticism around the time it takes for induction charging to occur with the strap.
The normal charger
box. So again, it's like a direct contact that you get with the watch. So hey, it solves a lot.
I do feel like that now that we've spoken about it, we have just given someone a lot of money.
Hopefully not. Hopefully that's not what we're here to do. We're here to inform the consumer at home. It's interesting what third-party accessories might come out.
With the watch, yeah. I can imagine the battery in your pocket with long leads sort of snaking up your arm and then plugging it into your watch. Just some extra power.
Yes, indeed. Now, shall we... I think it is getting to the end of the hour. Of course, we've got news with Byron Tompkins in the not-too-distant future. But we do have to wrap up the show. You're listening to TechnoGaze on Joy 94.9.
TechnoGaze.
Yes, you can check out the podcast on joy.org.au. It was very handy for me when I was overseas. That's the third time I dropped that into this show, isn't it?
You're sounding like somebody else I know on air. What's his name?
Anyway, now, just to finish up, speaking of it being overseas and flying, the Dreamliner, Boeing's next generation aeroplane, 787 Dreamliner.
What, the halt and catch fire one?
Yeah.
We were talking about batteries before.
Yes, the lithium ion batteries that caused certain concerns earlier on in its debut. Anyway, just recently there's been a software bug that's appeared in the Boeing 787 Dreamliner.
Oh, no.
And it's forced them, and, you know, it's more about the software these days with these things. So they've actually had to send out an airworthiness directive to shut down the plane's electrical power periodically.
Let me guess, they want to reboot it every now and then. Have they built this plane on Windows? And I said that to somebody, and the retort was, "Well, but even Linux has has issued a bug about this." And I said, "Yeah, the only difference is with Microsoft, it's a feature, not a bug."
So if it's been running for 248 days nonstop, then you need to shut it down and turn it back on. So keep that in mind if you own a 787. Now that's all we have time for today. If you missed any part of the show, or perhaps you're looking to listen to previous episodes, you can do so by going to joy.org.au/technogaze. Those words have changed just recently.
Well, that's what happens when you go home, Mark.
Indeed. Now, the news is next with Byron Tompkins, and for that is Dick with a Touch of Pink. I've always wanted to say that. whose single of the week is Ego. Now, have a great weekend, everyone. Thank you very much, Craig, for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, Michael, for pushing buttons and being and for doing a stellar job while I've been away.
That's not what you said to me before. Pulled out the long list. Thank you, Mark. It's been wonderful.
Catch you next week.
Technogaze on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.